And I could definitely talk about the government side in Bangladesh and the things that they're asked, just so you know, the things they're asking for: safety and security, citizenship and documentation, land and livelihood, freedom of movement and education.
That's very fucking basic.
It's super fucking basic. They
Can
should
you
call
ask
it this.
For less?
They should call it the super.
This is my
They should call
thing.
it the super fucking basic plan. Like, this is like not even close to freemium. You know, like, this is ridiculous. Like, they're not asking for much, and they said, we will voluntarily go back if you give us that. 82% of the people said they would return if given those five things. So, you know, just do obvious shit, and then you don't have this problem. But that's not what's going to happen. They're going to continue to. We didn't even talk about Bassam Char.
Good morning, everyone from Athens, Greece. Welcome to Fractured Podcast. This podcast is produced by this amazing family of Refocus Media Labs here in Athens. Fractured Podcast is our weapon to fight injustice. It's our way to give voice to refugees who don't have voice anywhere in the world. And in this episode 16, I have with me Douglas and Sonia, not as co-hosts, but as guests this time. Why? Because in 2018, these two amazing people went to the biggest, the largest refugee camp in the world in Bangladesh. What's the name?
Kutupalong.
Kutupalong, and reported from there and helped also. And I am sure that just a few people know about this issue, the crisis there. I was one of them. I had no idea about the Rohingya people, and that's why they are here with us to discuss this issue. Welcome on board.
We're happy to be here. And with just one host this time.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's
super exciting.
I'm the boss. So, Sonia, let's tell our listeners and viewers who are the Rohingya people.
So Rohingya or Rohingya, there are different
Rohingya.
Pronunciations
okay.
right
Rohingya.
Now that are allowed. This is an ethnic minority that traditionally lived in on the territory of Myanmar, Burma, in Rakhine State or Arakan, how it was called before. And this minority is one of the most persecuted minorities in the whole world. They traditionally lived in Myanmar, but at this moment, less than half of them live there. So it's around 400,000 people only still stayed in Myanmar, because starting from the 70s, massive persecution started in Myanmar with the goal to get them out of the country. And when we speak about massive persecutions, with time it went from bad to worse to absolutely horrible, because people were chased out of their villages. People were killed, women were raped, villages were set on fire on massive scale. And with every new wave of persecution, we saw that it was worse and worse and worse. So we had those big waves in the 70s, then 90s, early 2000s, and this really large group of people who came into Bangladesh and other neighboring countries in 2017. This was so far the largest attempt on genocide, I would say, on this community. So as an outcome of this, we have around 1 million Rohingya living in Bangladesh.
In one camp or in different
it's camps? In theory, mm-hmm. those are 33 camps, but they are
33.
Just yes, but they are just in a fake way, just divided so that international organizations can make sense of it. The largest one is called Kutupalong, and only in this place, in this one place, it is 500,000 people in a very, very dense environment. So it's a hut next to a hut next to a tent. It's incredible when you see this place.
But when you add up that whole area, you're over a million.
Yes, you're over a million.
In this area that was once just natural preserves. So now it's like a whole entire city of people. More people there than in San Francisco, only in like, you know, 10% of the landmass. It's like really, really dense.
But do we know, do we have a number of the Rohingya people? Like they left from Myanmar or no? Not the ones in the camp, the whole.
No, so we know that around like 1,400,000 is abroad right now in different countries. Mm-hmm. So it's Bangladesh is number one. Then we have India, Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia. I don't know if there are somebody in Malaysia.
None like majorly listed. It's predominantly Bangladesh and India are the two largest areas. And then some in the Western countries. But predominantly it's a... Once the people left, they left locally, they left regionally.
And those 400,000 that stayed in Myanmar.
In Myanmar. Mm-hmm. So why, Doc, why are they denied citizenship by Myanmar? Why this issue with Myanmar?
Well, if you really want to kind of like maybe take it back, Myanmar now is the official name of the country. It has once was called Burma, but the government kind of tried to... ironically, include all the ethnic minorities in the country by saying that calling it Burma would like kind of leave everybody out and only the Burman people would be represented. But in their language, it's the same. Myanmar and Burma is basically the same. But of the 135 ethnic minorities in the country, the Rohingya are not included. And back in 1982, they passed this law, forgetting what they called it. It was like a... Citizenship Act, right? Mm-hmm. And inside that, they basically strip them of their ability to be considered citizens. They have no right to reproduce. They have no right to educate themselves. They have really like fully restricted. They don't have freedom of movement. And it all kind of stems from the idea that the government in power in Burma, Myanmar, doesn't think that these Rohingya are actually from the region. They believe that they are historically imported labor from the British. But there's evidence of Rohingya people living inside the region for centuries, like thousands of years. It goes way back. And so as Sonia said, there's something called Arakan. It was like an Arakan. It's more like a region. Which included parts of what is modern Bangladesh, modern Myanmar, Burma, even further out. But generally speaking, the government doesn't see them as indigenous, so therefore they're not included in the ethnic minorities, and therefore they're seen as outsiders, they're ostracized as outsiders, and they're not allowed to have any type of citizenship or any type of normal rights inside the country.
So they are allowed to stay there without citizenship or no? They are not even allowed to stay there?
Yes, they are treated as foreigners in the territory of Myanmar, brought by Brits. They claim that they should be just named Bengali, that they were brought from the Bangladesh area. But what is important here that the fact that they are allowed to stay over the time, they were getting those different types of documentation, those white cards, to just like have any type of documentation. They give them very few rights. They cannot apply for all possible jobs. They, as Doug said, they need to get a permission to get married and have children. This is like they have to get permission from
each other.
Okay. Not I'm not talking about mixed marriages. Mm. It's a marriage between Rohingya. So imagine like you have to go to local authorities in your region to get formal permission to do that, right? They officially ban them from entering any education above to age of 12, right?
Yeah.
This is the only education you can get. Then below, so as an outcome of this, many Rohingya are illiterate. They cannot count. Writing is a massive, massive problem, even among grown-ups.
But they also limited what they could study. So you were only allowed to learn Burmese. You were only allowed to learn, ironically, English. But you were not allowed to learn like your ethnic language. So they were, again, trying to squeeze this out. And we see this a lot in a lot of places, like in China, stops Tibetans from being able to speak their native language. And if it's stripped from the school system and it's no longer available to people, then it's really reliant upon just what happens in the home. But if the previous generation suffered the same fate, then slowly but surely the culture kind of shifts away or slides away.
Is it written, their language, or
yeah,
spoken?
Yeah.
Okay, so they write it also.
Yep, they write it and they speak it, and it's it looks similar to Burmese. It's actually close to they have a dialect that's close to the local dialect in Bangladesh in the city of Chittagong, which is the largest city on the south east coast of Bangladesh, which is closest to this region. And this is kind of where they claim that they all should be back to, like that they're not from here, they're outsiders, and they just rewrite the history to clarify that, or claim that the British brought them as labor, but that's not actually true.
And what was your motivation to go there? The camp?
Well, I think everyone in 2017, we saw like the news about, like, everyone paid attention to this thing as it was kicking off in that summer in late August, early September. But I had like connected with a photographer, a photojournalist named Greg Constantine, and he worked with the Pulitzer Center back in the States. And he actually came and visited my media and photography class in Philadelphia and was working with our students about this issue. About statelessness, and he's got a lot of different projects centered around this. And it's not just people, it's not just Rohingya, it's not just people in this particular region. It's like globally, his work is about statelessness. I think you would really love to interview him at some point. About 10 million people globally are officially stateless, and it's not by anything more than a stroke of a political pen that leaves people in this situation. So meeting Greg and then working with him and having him engage with our students about how he structured his workflow, it really kind of piqued my interest into the issue. I kind of stayed, you know, peripherally engaged with it as he went to do his stuff, and then I worked on different projects on my own. But then when this kicked off, it was immediately like jump into the project, and then we had an opportunity to go in the early part of 2018 to investigate, report, and then also provide some programming for people inside the camps.
Cool. So, Sonia, what did you experience there? Lost my voice. The activities you did there, what did you see? What affected you?
So this is probably a topic for a whole podcast. What we did, first of all, we stayed in a town called Cox's Bazar. To get to the camps, there's no place you can stay close to the camps. There's simply nothing. There's one more small town called Ukia, but there's nothing, like no extra hostels, like people who can host you. So every day we were basically going to the camp with those buses or those CNGs, those like small motorbikes with like extra seats. And it took us like 2 hours to get there. We would predominantly stay in Kutupalong, so this largest camp with 500,000 people. And, you know, first of all, it doesn't look like this anymore, but when we came there and we entered, we were allowed to enter freely. We didn't have to register. There were army people in front of the camp. But you have to understand that, like, entering the camp is you're entering from a market, a food market. Mm-hmm. So you basically go through some small streets, and then at some point you are inside a camp.
There's no gate or something.
No,
that says
no, there was really nothing. Okay. Nothing really. We partnered with one organization, so the manager brought us there. But literally, you have to know that this is the camp. It's changed now, so now the access to the camp is partly restricted, meaning like you have to register, you have to be allowed to work with some organizations to go inside. But we just entered, and I remember that for the first 2 weeks of our stay there, we haven't seen even one Westerner. We were the only people there who were like doing some kind of a programming or a job from the West. It's bad and it's good at the same time, because many organizations just hired local community to do some of the work, but they also didn't go to the camp frequently at the time. So when you enter the camp and you stand on one of the hills, it's a very hilly, beautiful region, you just see the camp spreading to eternity. I swear, like, you cannot see the end of the camp. And the view you have is basically one small hut that people built for themselves next to another. And in some areas, the distance between those huts is like less than a meter. So it's just one next to another, one next to another. People build them for themselves because there were no NGOs, no organizations to give them tents or build ISO boxes. There's nothing like this. It's extremely, extremely basic. If people didn't have any tarp to put on those on those houses, they would simply get some kind of garbage bags, something that can just cover them, especially from rain, because during the monsoon season it's very rainy there. And the hygienic situation in the camp, you can imagine how absolutely terrible this is. Those wells and toilets, they are not, when people first came, they just dig holes and they didn't dig them deep enough. So whenever there's a flooding, and it happens pretty frequently, everything goes out, right? You have, there's one small river next to the camp, and you just really cannot tell where the river ends and the sewage starts. So the hygienic situation is extremely problematic. You can imagine, like, suddenly, within a month, 500,000 people comes to one region. Like, how are you handling it? How would a rich Western nation handle it? Not mentioning Bangladesh, right? Bangladesh, where the income is completely different, resources are completely different. So what we saw there, predominantly what we went there for, is to provide some basic education. And we tried to do our regular media course, but also we taught basic, we thought it's going to be English classes, but it was basically basic reading and writing of letters, counting for children. And we partnered with a foundation called Mastul, and they built a school where children could come. I remember the day of the opening, the crowd was just gigantic. People, not everybody could fit in, so people were standing in front.
I saw the picture,
yeah. Yeah, like looking through the window. Children came with parents, and it was a massive thing. We organized some activities for them, which was like definitely too much for two people and then few extra volunteers to organize. And the problem there is that there's no access to education for anybody. So first of all, the Bangladeshi government doesn't allow Rohingya to study the Bangladeshi curricula. They don't want them there. This is the problem. So you can only study inside the camp. Whatever is provided by NGOs is in the camp. And this is not a place like here in Europe where we have so many Western NGOs trying to organize classes. So if children really want to learn, they will find some organization. They can choose from several. No, like in those places, there are very few of them. There's UNICEF trying to provide some learnings. And there are madrasas. So most children are taught Quran, and it's a very religious approach. So our small project was trying to bring a little bit of that to the camp. It is changing a little bit, but definitely not much. There are some NGOs, predominantly actually there were Turkish NGOs. And this is because at some point when the massive exodus started happening and people were crossing to Bangladesh, Erdogan's wife came to Bangladesh to visit Kutupalong, and she got very, very emotional about the situation. She saw all the kids and the women, and she appealed to Turkish NGOs to support the people. It is important to say, I think we didn't mention it, that Rohingya are Muslims. And this was the main thing. Like, yeah, we have to help our brothers in faith, right? So there are, like, you can see many Turkish flags in the camp.
While she left her husband, go and destroy Syria.
Wow,
amazing. Mm.
This is one of the another reasons why they can be seen as outsiders is that 90% of Myanmar Burma is Buddhist. So they're automatically always seen as outside because their culture and their religion and their everything is different. So not all Rohingya are Muslim. There are some Hindu and some Christians as well, but the overwhelming majority of them are Muslim. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of getting persecuted on religious grounds as well.
This is what I don't understand. I thought that Buddhists are like more chill down and like, you know, Zen. What the hell? And I want to know what, like, is this conflict religious or ethnic or why? What's the reason behind this conflict there between the Burma and the Rohingya?
Yeah, I think it would definitely be a very, it's a weird image in your mind to think of like, a Buddhist monk with a gun or a person who practices Buddhism facilitating any type of, you know, any type of violence, because we see it in the West as like this nonviolent direct action to, you know, this is the response even to direct violence. But we see that in many places that, you know, societies are societies. And if you are going to be riled up by fanatical politicians or people in power, or there's a junta and you have military control there, you know, it's interesting enough that in Myanmar, Burma, you would see like a lot of peaceful protests from the Buddhist community, from monks, and they would get squashed by the military. There's an open civil war in the country right now that is raging for the last 2 years after another junta, and that was after a decade of losing power. So, you know, it's a very complex situation there. When you look at a map, even though the current military government has the major cities, there's like 900 colors of all the different rebel groups all over the country that are fighting for power and to fight against the current government and the military. But I would say that it's a mixture. It's not just that they're ethnically different or that they're religiously different. It's just that the majority has been riled up to look at them as outsiders, and most of them were actually also contained into one region right at the border with Bangladesh. So there's not a huge percentage of Rohingya in other parts of the country. Most of the country is actually broken down by the ethnic population, like the ethnic classifications are, it's kind of segregated. It's like you go into Kachin State or Karen State or these other areas in the country, and then it's almost predominantly one thing. So the states themselves inside Burma are very segregated, so to speak, or homogenous. And then again, regionally, all the Rohingya are right along the border with Bangladesh, where they weren't living until these modern conflicts from the 70s forward. So the last 50 years, you see this return of Rohingya to Bangladesh, but prior to that, they weren't really there. It's not like, oh, they slowly migrated to Myanmar and now they're back. They were just in Myanmar before.
Were they ever in power, Rohingya?
No.
Never. In Myanmar, never.
No.
Did they have any party?
They
were never allowed.
No.
Absolutely nothing. And this is one of the things that they highlight, that the ethnic cleansing or genocide that is happening, was happening. Actually, it is still happening. Could happen because they have no power. Because they, first of all, are uneducated predominantly. In our whole journey, we met so many people, and we haven't met one person that would have a higher education of any type. First of all, so they are illiterate predominantly. Children do not go to schools. So they imagine, how do you form any type of political power in this situation when you cannot even really register or understand how to register, how to build structures and campaign? And they are saying that this situation happened because they didn't have this power, because they were uneducated and couldn't advocate for themselves. When this last wave of ethnic cleansing happened, at the beginning, nobody knew about this. And they couldn't, you know, warn the world to say like, okay, something's happening again to us. It's just like, okay, Western journalists, go get some information, go back. It's like Burma is a very close country at the moment. But they don't have any type of councils abroad to advocate, to be vocal about their cause. There's almost nothing. Throughout the history, they had no political power anywhere.
So did Bangladesh claim them? Did they invite them over or no?
No.
So they just.
No, it's quite the opposite.
Okay, so they don't even want them.
No.
And until today, so UNHCR admits that Rohingya are refugees. They fulfill any possible criteria of being a refugee. However, Bangladeshi government is not part of the 1951 Refugee Convention. So they did not give Rohingya officially the refugee status. They are in their territory. They have some kind of UNHCR registration papers, but they are not officially recognized by them. Now, why? Obviously, if you recognize somebody as a refugee, you have to give them the rights, right? You have to get a right to work and so on. Now, this million people right now in this area, when they enter the job market in a country that already, you know, pays people very, very little for their labor, this lowers the prices even more. And it doesn't mean that the Rohingya don't work. They do. They usually work, you know, without contracts, especially in like this hard physical work. And there are more and more protests against that. So there are local communities who are, just a few days ago, there was an interview with this local community, and they asked the authorities in the region to stop any refugees, any Rohingya, from working, because they lowered the salaries even more. Rohingya would work for something like $2 to $3 a day, and the local community right now are working for $6 a day. And you know, day for them is not like for us, 8 hours and that's it. This is a very long day from morning till very late night hours. So it's a very, very difficult situation. But yes, definitely Bangladesh doesn't want them there. However, Bangladesh welcomed them when they arrived. So they crossed predominantly this Naf River that is between Myanmar and Bangladesh. They came on those boats. Some people drowned. It's not very far away. It's not the small river, but
look across and it's just a big river.
Yeah, it's just a big river.
Easily see the other side.
Yes.
Okay. It's not like from Turkey to Greece.
No.
It's much smaller. Mm-hmm. So when they crossed, some of them drowned. Some people were exhausted from the journey, but most of them managed to come. And when they came, they're telling us that it was a shock to them that army just came, brought them to another area, gave them water, gave them some kind of food and so on. They were shocked because in their country, the army was predominantly persecuting them.
Oh, okay.
So they did horrible things to them. They were fearing of the uniform. But there, when they saw the first soldiers, they couldn't believe that they're treating them with some kind of a kindness. However, this is changing. Because, you know, yes, of course, we understand the situation, but now money is not coming to this region. So Bangladesh has to basically handle it almost on their own. UNHCR every year is asking for a certain amount of money. They're not even getting 1/3 of what they're calculating their needs are, right? And those are very basic needs. They don't even have a large educational programming. It's basic housing, predominantly food in the camps. Like 90, I think everybody at this moment are totally dependable on humanitarian aid. When we were there, the number was 90% of people had to get food from UNHCR or other international institutions. Otherwise, they wouldn't eat. They just don't have any other income.
But this was the same. I mean, now it's estimated it's like 875 million to maintain this space, this area, which is basically like a city. So think of Kutupalong, Tangkali, Balukali, Nayapara. Like these are these major like population centers in this originally natural forest called Teknaf. Like this area was just unpopulated. It was totally rural. There were more elephants than people, right? It was just jungle, and now it's a city. And so imagine it's like the budget of a city is almost a billion, right? And that's how much it takes, but they're only getting like 30% of that right now from humanitarian aid. So the World Food Program said that they had to lower the food support from 12 euros a month to 8 euros a month, which means that it's a month, not a day, but a month.
Per day, per person, right?
So then it's down to like 9 cents a meal. Like that's how much support they have based off of what's available in terms of international donors, international support for the community.
But that's the so only help they're getting. Food.
That's all they're getting. And well, just generally speaking, like generally speaking, like there's lots of different schemes mm-hmm. to provide different types of mm-hmm. supports in the region. But when you add up all the actual money to cover those costs, they 75% of their operating budget is unfunded. It doesn't exist. They don't have enough for it. So you see all of the aid. You know, all the programming that the aid agencies are providing is being slashed like dramatically. And this is at around the same time that it's even harder to work. So after COVID, you almost can't get out of the camp to go work. Like it's become much more restrictive for someone to leave the camp and then get into society and kind of do gray work, like something off the books. It's really hard.
Yeah, this is also why volunteering doesn't exist in those camps. You know, what we saw in many camps here, people who are waiting for their asylum in camps, they would gladly support other organizations, volunteer, help with something. Something like this doesn't exist in Bangladesh because if they can get money from somewhere, they will ask for money. So everything that was built in the camp, like for example, the school we taught in, any madrasas, any mosques, everything was built by them. And predominantly international organizations would pay locals to locals Rohingya in the camp to build those facilities.
And facilitate a lot of the stuff that I think international media gets for free when they travel to other crisis zones. The people were not seen as sources. They were treated with a whole lot of this is an actual employment opportunity. So translation, like fixers, people taking you into an area, being able to meet people that would be sitting for interviews. Like there was a healthy ecosystem of pay to play for the international agencies or the news desks or anyone coming in to do the work. You had to compensate people fairly. And this is the opposite of what we experienced mm-hmm. in the borders of Europe, where for years everyone was just expected to do it for free. And then when you try to pay someone, you can't find the money suddenly. Now suddenly this very cashed up entity doesn't have any budget for this project. And you're like, But, you know, so it was refreshing to see that people were immediately we're talking about like weeks into the crisis hotspot, people were already being compensated for their support and the relief work that they're doing. But the same level of engagement unfolded as we saw. You go back to 1516 in Greece, you see all the boats, and it was in every news report, and then eventually that faded from the headlines. And that's kind of what the reporting looked like there. For like a hot 2 months, it was in the news all the time, and it was these images of people crossing the rivers or getting in the boats and coming across, and then kind of nothing. It just faded away.
So we will see during the break an interview with one of the people who helped us, supported us there. Her name is Samuda, and she's talking about her desire for higher education.
All right. See you in a bit. Bye-bye. Twinkle, twinkle, little star.
How I wonder what you are. I wonder what you like. Like a diamond in the sky.
I'm Samuda. I was born in Kutuhal Rohingya refugee camp. My mother has come in from Myanmar in 1993. I study in intermediate second year. When I go to school, I have to secret my identity. We said that we are Bangladeshi. Actually, if they now, mm-hmm. if they can now, I'm a Rohingya, they will. They will not give me opportunity to study. I don't like to stay in Bangladesh because I don't feel good. Because there is no opportunity. I cannot mm-hmm. study finally. I cannot what I wish. I cannot do. Mm-hmm. I cannot feel my dream. So I don't like to stay. Actually, I went to be a doctor so that in Myanmar, there is no a doctor, a good doctor. They are not female. Mm-hmm. The female are feel shame mm-hmm. to go to, if any female feel, if any female sick, they do not go to the doctor because they feel shame. Actually, I am also.
Yes.
If I feel sick, I don't like to go to female doctor. There is no female doctor, so I went to be a female doctor. How to? I can help them. There are many problems. When I go to be a doctor, I have to study by science, science subject. But in the good high school, there is no opportunity to study for Rohingya. I study in Madrasa, but there is no science. So now I am studying with general subject. After joining my INOVAT, I have also make a dream that to be a good interpreter. Because in our Myanmar, there is no a good interpreter. So we cannot express our emotion if any foreigner or journalist come to take information. Anybody can't express their emotion. So we are so behind. Our nation is our nation is unable to develop. So I think that though in our Myanmar came has interpreter, but there is no female interpreter. Inshallah, I expect that I will be a good doctor and also a good interpreter to help our nation, to help the person. Not only our nation, not only Rohingya, any person.
I'm sure you will.
If I think that if anybody help us, inshallah, I will be able.
Welcome back from the break. I hope you enjoyed the first part because I really did, and I cannot wait to dive in into the second part. And we go to talk this time with the name Rohingya. The government of Myanmar refused to use even the name. In the 2014 census, the Myanmar government forced the Rohingya to identify themselves as Bengali. Many Rohingya see the denial of their name as similar to denying their basic rights. So why they don't even want to let them use this name and identify as they want to be?
Well, I mean, we talked a little bit about the citizenship law in the 80s that they put into action. And, you know, back then they called them Bengali aliens.
Bengali aliens.
Yeah, it's like in the language of the law. They just do not see them as members of the larger society. They're trying to create this extra category for them that clarifies why they're not entitled to anything. So they don't recognize their group. They see them as just people that should be from Bangladesh at this point in their minds, that they were never from this area. This is their tried and true like platform. They've never really pulled back from that. They've only intensified it. And then that intensity turned into violence, extreme violence, over the course of these past four decades. So, I mean, there's no like wiggle room there on their side.
People become more and more aware of the fact that this is their basic right to choose how they're being named. If this was their traditional name for centuries, why can they not register right now in documents with this name? And they started, for example, in the camps every year at the anniversary of the last massive persecutions. It's the end of August. They protest. It's a very peaceful protest. They just demand to be recognized and, strangely maybe for some people, allowed back into Rakhine State with all the possible rights. So they start educating themselves and learn what is their basic right, that those things that were denied to them for many, many decades are actually something absolutely normal.
I saw this book on Amazon. It's called First They Erased Our Name, A Rohingya Speaks, by Habibur Rahman and Sufi Ansar, and tells the story of this guy who was born in 1979, and after that he found himself stateless in his own country, in Burma, and mentioned that
The Rohingya were not one of the 135 recognized ethnic groups. Mm-hmm. And what goes in my mind, like, you recognize 135,
yeah,
and you couldn't recognize one.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we say, okay, we had two or three, all right, we can understand. They were segregated for this reason. But 135 ethnic groups, mm-hmm, were recognized, and mm-hmm, Rohingya, no.
No. No, this is what they did already right after the Myanmar stopped being British colony,
mm-hmm,
when they first did the whole list of all ethnicities. They didn't recognize.
But who did this list?
So the people who were at power at the time, right?
Not the British.
Not the British.
No, this is like 48.
Yes.
Okay.
And it just continued through the next, Doug mentioned the 1982 Citizenship Act. It continued.
Mm.
And they were at some point, there were like four stages of citizenship in Myanmar, and they were not even entitled to like the lowest one. The whole issue was like they sort of had a path to get documents,
mm,
by proving that they were living there before 1948, so before the Brits left this place. However, they had to have like formal documents. And those formal documents would come from local authorities, for example, oh, like that they own this land or mm, something of this sort. And they couldn't get it. They simply didn't have, in reality, a path to claim this this citizenship. So they were basically living as, at this moment, most of them are predominantly stateless because they are not recognized anywhere. The ones in site Myanmar, some of them still have some documents. At some point they had this mm, white card that was then taken away from them with a promise that they will get national ID. This never happened.
Mm.
So it's an extremely problematic situation because without documents you really cannot do anything, yeah, in any country.
Yeah, and the photographer I was talking about earlier, Greg mm, Constantine, he's been doing a project right now. He did a project for a while called Nowhere People, but it's more global. Mm-hmm. But then he did one in particular about Rohingya. It's called Ek Kale, which Once Upon a Time is this translation for
like
the title. And
or?
it's a resource,
okay,
of
mm-hmm,
archival photos, video clips, documents,
mm-hmm,
all sorts of really amazing things that help chronicle the history of the people that go all the way back.
Mm-hmm.
Like well before the British men, they like you know like tons of archival evidence of who owned what, deeds to land, presence, university, you know, representation, like people in society, and all specifically Rohingya. So it's coming out this year at some point in 2024. So the website we'll put in the show notes, I guess, so people
mm-hmm,
can
yeah,
check it out and follow it.
Yeah.
Like Greg's work has been like pretty seminal in the documentation and the helping raise awareness. For 20 years
mm-hmm,
he's been working with this community, so it's really, really a dense understanding of what's gone on there.
Do you think the British has a hand in this? And how was the situation of Rohingya during the British colonial period?
Well, I mean, I don't necessarily know that they had a specific hand in like
mm-hmm,
what's happening to them now. But if you think about any colonial power and the way they handle the locality that they were going into, to most of it is an extractionary
mm-hmm,
measure. They're there for natural resources or they're there for geopolitical purposes. And once they're there, it's pretty tried and true, the divide and conquer mentality or strategy, where you pit groups against one another
mm-hmm,
to minimize their potential capacity to rise up against you. So the irony here is that there's this outside force that comes in and they destabilize a region, take what they want, and then eventually when it's no longer financially feasible for them to maintain that power, they leave. Then they normally empower a minority group to kind of create a whole lot of mm-hmm, political and, you know, like societal conflict. And we see this playing out all over Sub-Saharan Africa, in Southeast Asia, in Latin America, in South America, in plenty of places. Like
they do with Pakistan?
Yeah.
Also.
Like, I mean, pretty much everywhere you're going, you're going to see when a big power leaves, there's a vacuum, and that vacuum tends to be filled by a lot of warring factions, and you see that politically as well.
Yeah.
So if all of these places inside Burma at the time were kind of homogenous, like regionally, they then have a lot of autonomy or power in those particular spaces. And politically speaking, in Burma, they had like some sort of normalization over the last like 10 years with democracy. They were sliding towards more semi-autonomous states. Think about like what Catalonia was trying to do in Spain, or different regions in Spain where it's you know, one nation, but it has very, very unique regional characteristics and languages and cultures, and many of them fight for political autonomy. The same thing was happening there. And I think that's one of the reasons why this region can be exploited, or this group can be exploited, because they were the predominant ethnic group in that area. So if they are out, or if the majority of them are forced out, then suddenly you go from a 99% majority to a 50-50 split, or potentially even a minority inside their own traditional territory. And we see that kind of playing out in a lot of places. So from a historical standpoint, maybe the British were not explicitly involved in what's happening now, but the ramifications of the decisions they made before upon their exit absolutely are felt now.
Sonia, what happened during the refugee crisis of 1991-1992?
This was one of the largest crackdown on Rohingya. So what happened is the army decided to introduce this new operation in Rakhine State, and the name of it was called Clean and Beautiful Nation, or Beautiful and Clean Nation. This is how they called the operation of basically immense violence on Rohingya people. And when you think about this, as an outcome of this, around 200,000-250,000 Rohingya left at that time. Most of them went to Bangladesh. But when you think about the language here, right? Why would you call a military operation, like a really violent operation, Clean and Beautiful Nation? This is what they wanted to do. They were claiming that Rohingya are the ones who are dirty, ugly, not fitting our society, right? And when you think about how genocide is happening, it's never an act. It's always a process. You tell people that others are worse, are different, are a threat to you. You build it, right, in society. And this is how people get used to this opposition, us, them, right? Yeah. We are what represents all the good things, and they are what represents danger and the bad things, right? So we had this massive act of violence in the early 90s. We had one in the 70s, and then it kept repeating. Okay. Basically, from the 90s, it was almost an ongoing violence in the region.
And why is that in that specific years in the 90s?
So it started in the it's all connected to of course the ruling of the of the military, right? And sometimes there was a very, I don't want to say a very simple reason, because it was usually some kind of a violence or fight that started this massive violence, right? In the region, Rohingya actually have something that is called Arakan, help me, Doug.
Arakan is the
Arakan is the area.
The area.
Arakan's Arsa. Sorry, Arsa. Yes, that's the acronym for the rebels, basically Rohingya rebels, who are fighting against Myanmar army. And now, when we say rebels, you really have to imagine people not in uniforms, people in regular clothes with usually some sticks. They do not have arms. It's just whatever they can do. But there are actually two types of like rebel armies in this region representing. I'm using this word, but it's not the right reason, because they are rebel groups, but they do not represent really Rohingya's views. But they are fighting the army in the region. And sometimes, like in this last wave of violence from 2017, they attacked a post office, if I'm not mistaken. And as an outcome of this, 12 security guys died, 12 people who were from Myanmar, right? So they died. And as an outcome of this, the army decided to introduce this massive payback. And it didn't matter that those rebels did this. They started persecuting the civilians, right? Like village people who had nothing to do with that.
The ones who stayed in Myanmar.
Yes. Wow. Yes. So, and then it was so massive. It was so big because it was a payback for the death of those 12 security guys that, like, you know, now we have almost a million people in Bangladesh because of that.
And then over this time period, every decade or so, there's a flare up, so to speak, as they call it, or an instance where there's violence, and there's always some moment or some spark, right? Something that will happen. But if you go back in the historical annals of civil rights in America and Jim Crow eras, and, like, you know, it's the same kind of a thing where it's one isolated moment. One person did something. Normally a man did something from the ethnic minority group, did something to a woman from the other group, the majority group. And then that became the justification for, like, brutal violence. So the same kind of thing happens. But every time it happens, another 10, 20, 30, 50, 100,000, 500,000, a million people exit stage left. And when that happens, all of a sudden, this population drops dramatically. So now you're down to, like, somewhere between 400,000 to 600,000 Rohingya left inside modern borders of Myanmar, of Burma. And of them, 100,000 of them are in internally displaced detention camps. So you're down to, like, somewhere between, you know, like, say 300,000 people from a previous total of around 2 million. So, I mean, and then they don't have the right... I want to reiterate this. In that law in 1982, you did not have the right to reproduce. Like, you're not allowed to reproduce. You're not allowed to study your language. You're not allowed to educate yourself. I mean, this is insanity. Like, but this was passed as legislation. So that lasts for a decade, and then 10 more years of people thinking a certain way. And then a moment happens, and they easily use that moment as the excuse for more violence. So... fast forward 40, 50 years later, there'll be no, like, from now, if this continues unabated and it continues every so on, there'll be no one left. They'll all be...
and that's what they want.
...relocated. And I that's believe that that's all they really want, because, you know, that's actually all they're ever saying. Like, what was the title of this campaign?
Clean and beautiful nation.
Wow.
Okay, that's just, that's fucked up.
No, I just want to say something about what Sonia said about the clean and beautiful... country
nation.
So I remember there's this book called Hitler's Table Talk. So someone had to document Hitler when he was unofficially talking to his friends on the table, and he pitched this idea to Hitler. Hitler's like, yeah, of course. And in one of the, I was reading it, and then they said that Hitler didn't start of let's kill the Jews. At the beginning, he said, I want to literally clean the city from all the cockroaches and the stuff. So he was cleaning everywhere. And then he said, now I want to clean it from the Jews. So this idea of these people are the dirt and we need to take them out. So it exists in many places. And when you are, you know, exposed to this injustice, you want to fight back. You want to push. And I'm wondering how people there are fighting in Rohingya. How do they fight? Is it armed? Is it political? Do they even fight?
Yeah. Well, like Sonia was saying, that the ARSA is inside the country, and they are fighting
in Myanmar.
In Myanmar, in Rakhine State. They are actively in rebellion, and there are many, many groups that are in active rebellion against the current military junta that's in power. Since 21, there's a mega civil war unfolding. And we could show you a map of, all, like we said earlier, that all the colors that represent the different groups.
Yeah.
It looks like the whole color wheel is there. You know, it's really insane. But inside Bangladesh, their problems are quite different, because they're kind of battling for rights as refugees. And there are some organizations that are inside the camps now. And this is actually what you'll hear about more in the news, is about that there are armed groups inside the camps, and that there's a couple of factions that are kind of fighting against each other. And it's led to a lot of violence in the past 2 years. And they are, we we've had almost 100 people have died in the last 2 years inside the camps, and this is from this inter-gang violence. It's not at the level of madness of what you see unfolding in Haiti after the government collapse and the gangs took power in a unity plan. These two factions are fighting against each other for power on, like, illicit trade. There's a drug called Yaba that comes across the border that's basically methamphetamines laced with caffeine and some other chemicals, and it's, like, super highly addictive.
It comes from where?
It comes out of Burma. It comes out of Myanmar.
Out of Burma to the camp.
Yeah, yeah. So it's, again, it's just crossing a river. So there's, like, illegal things that are making its way out of the country.
But stays in the
area
camp?
Of the world has consistently been a producer of drugs and narcotics. There's a famous place called the Golden Triangle at the top between Thailand, Laos, and Burma. And this area there was the number one, like, drug production place in the region. And so stuff is getting out of Myanmar into Bangladesh through the camp.
Okay.
Child, you know, like, there's sex trafficking, there's all sorts of illegal smuggling, all sorts of things happening. And those people that have this influence or have the manpower, the firepower, they are fighting each other for supremacy. So now the actual, when we were in the camp, you know, there was this, like, kind of, like, unofficial yet official curfew, because, as you said, that there's no gate that lets you in and out. It's much more like you entered a city, got off a bus, you're at a stop, you walk down a dirt path, and you're in a community. So there was no real get out by this hour, but there was an unofficial, like, once the sun goes down, it's dusk, everyone leaves. And then now, but we were walking around at night, we stayed in there much later. Now it's dangerous. Local people are reporting that it's no longer safe for them to make their way around their respective areas, that there is violence now, and there is lawlessness in the space that is kind of a new manifestation of the past year and a half or so. It's really exponentially grown.
Is there, like, someone or a group that's responsible for this, for the camp? Like the government, small government, a council?
This was nuts what you found.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This is actually very interesting because Bangladesh doesn't have any body responsible for migration and asylum. Nothing. So there's no migration ministry.
No ministry. Okay, okay.
There's no minister. There's no deputy. Nothing. So they're basically deciding on the asylum seekers in Bangladesh with letters, decrees. Some locals decide on what is going to happen. So there's no policy towards this. There's no plan what to do with such a gigantic group of refugees. Nothing. They don't even have one person who would report on that and what is happening. Everything we know is the numbers, the big numbers. It's UNHCR who does the countdown, and the rest, it's other international organizations who are there. But from the government, we barely get any information.
The government's been beating this solitary drum for a while of saying the only solution is repatriation and send the people back, right? But it's still an active conflict zone. Nothing changed. It actually got worse. But when we were there in 18, at that time, there were bilateral agreements between the government of Myanmar and Bangladesh to repatriate a certain percentage of people, and they were going to pilot the project and only take voluntary returns.
Okay.
And the people who were going to voluntarily return would only do so if they had certain basic, simple demands met, right? Like citizenship and documentation and access to education, and, like, really, really obvious things, right? But then it didn't go through, but we were there on, like, and there was, like, a weekend of, like, it's happening. This is going to happen now. And everyone was running and hiding. Nobody wanted to potentially get swept up in a forced repatriation, which has happened in the past. There have been multiple forced repatriations, which is illegal, but it's happened. And then if you think about, you know, we're here in Greece, and, you know, you hear about refugees that get picked up by the police and the West Coast. They're trying to maybe get to Italy via the ferries, and then somehow they end up in Turkey. Geographically, that's kind of difficult without some sort of illegal operation. Now, imagine this is just across the river. This would be much more like you got caught in Evros at the border of Turkey, and then you end up in Turkey. That's sort of like the geographical reality of what is like in Bangladesh between Burma. But the political reality in Bangladesh is that they've never accepted responsibility. They've never given them refugee status. The only people that have ever gotten refugee status were from the 90s. and they all live in the Nayapara area, which is like right, it's the closest area to the border, and that is the only area that has had that's been allowed to have any type of formal settlement being built. So none of the other environments have they even allowed them to build formal homes. So everything is just made out of sticks and whatever they can forage, and an outrageous amount of the national forest has been destroyed just to produce shelters, but nothing permanent has been allowed, and it's been 6 years. So they just really refused to let them officially stay.
And who did choose this place, this area, to say they should stay here? Because you said it was inhabited by elephants and animals. It was just like an Amazon thing. So who decided that they should stay there?
It happened basically organically because they crossed the river more or less in this area. So in really big numbers. So when they were crossing, at some point, the government probably decided that they cannot go farther towards the bigger cities, because what are they going to do with them in those cities? They will have a massive homeless problem. I mean, there is a big homeless problem in Bangladesh in general, but they just stopped them at some point. And people just came, they were exhausted, and they just started building some kind of a small shelters, huts in this area. And it was a natural process. Those were hills with a big forest. And as Doug said, they were like, it was a natural path of elephants. So they were like crossing always. And we heard several stories of people in the camp being basically smashed by elephants because the elephants were just confused. It was a forest. Suddenly somebody chopped down all the trees and they do not have this natural path, right? So they would enter the camp and people would get hurt because of that.
I mean, this is just a geographical restriction in its simplest form. They crossed the river. They just held them on the other bank of the river. They just held them on the west side instead of allowing them, and with the understanding that they would send them back to the east side of the river once the violence stopped. But it never stopped. It just exacerbated. It continued. It's expanded. But they've just held them there. And then out of necessity on a daily basis, you know, people find shelter, people create shelter, people create ecosystems. When we got there, it was just a little bit after like the big exodus. It wasn't that far removed. It was a couple of months. And it was like a teeming city, fully functioning. Like you just full marketplaces, everything you could imagine was unfolding in a way as if you kind of just got off a bus in some part of another country. And then here's what everyone lives like here in terms of standard of living. And in some respects, it feels like maybe their standard of living in this space was very similar to what it was like on the other side, because they were restricted and like, you know, not allowed to really formulate any type of permanent presence. So they just continued to do what they would have been doing back home, just in a new environment. And then they just foraged for new resources.
Is there a physical limits to this camp, like wires or something?
You would think that there is, but you'd be surprised that people can live like this.
No, but the Bangladesh, they said they want them to stay there, so they don't want them to run away and go inside. Yeah. So
I mean, prior to COVID, there really weren't any limitations. That the military, the Bangladesh military, was in charge, and they had checkpoints that we went through regularly to go in and out. But there was no physical, like modern checkpoint the way you would consider like a passport control scenario for a border. And there were not barbed wire fences. But then after COVID, they did start erecting certain restrictive boundaries to stop people from coming out. And then again, they used, contain health concerns as a as a reason for justifying more restrictions. And we've seen this globally. But as it stands now, we were talking to some of our former colleagues there, or people that they're saying that generally it's not like impossible to leave the region. It's not like they're in quote unquote an open air prison, but it's not easy. And most people don't, because there's not a whole lot of opportunity for them to do things in regular society.
Yeah. When we're talking about leaving the camp, so some of them leave, they have usually fake documents. And on those documents, it says that they are Bangladeshi. Because if they're Bangladeshi, they are allowed to study outside the camp. So they use whatever resources they have to simply produce those documents and then leave. If they speak on those checkpoints, we're like checking it. But women, they were usually not even burqas, not even hijabs, but they're wearing sometimes niqabs. So basically, only see the eyes. So it's hard to actually, you know, decide who's who. And with those fake documents, they can leave and study, but they all return to the camp for the night because they don't have other options, right? And basically, they're going north from the camp towards Koskokos' bazaar, where the first like bigger city is. There are only two roads going there. One is this very nice road going along the coast, and they only allow certain organizations and some locals going there. All those CNGs stay in this massive traffic going the other road because they do not want this beautiful road going along the largest, the longest beach in the world, by the way, to, you know, distract the view and the beauty of this place.
How many kilometers did you said, Doug?
Oh, the beach?
Yeah.
It's like supposed to be the longest straight beach, unobstructed beach is like 120 kilometers of straight sand.
It's just, you know, it's going along this long part of
but
land.
It's a, you know, it's not really, I mean, I think they've been trying to market it as yeah, like, you know, here's like a potential for tourism, and it's completely undeveloped. It's just wild beach. It's just wild. Most of it is wild.
There were some hotels built at this, but like there was still so much space for, I mean, Westerners would see just a wasted opportunity for income, right, in this area. But it's very beautiful and natural.
Yep.
Okay, now the question that I don't want to ask, but people need to know. Sonia, can you tell us about the genocide? What happened?
So, first of all, there's a dispute whether this is genocide or are those ethnic cleansings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, basically the difference between genocide and ethnic cleansing is pretty small because the methods are the same. Ethnic cleansing means that people just want you out of the land. They use violence to get you out of the land. Genocide means that they want you dead, your nation, right? So here's the thing. So in November 2019, the Gambia came with a claim to International Court of Justice against Myanmar. And this claim is still ongoing. And the Gambia accused Myanmar of genocide. There were several people who
Country Gambia?
The country.
The African country.
Yes, the tiny country, the Gambia. But they did it on behalf, as a proxy of Organization of Islamic Cooperation. You know, a very big group of states. But they are officially the ones who brought the claim. And I think last year, several countries joined them. For sure, Canada and I think five European countries, UK, Germany, France, for sure, Netherlands and Denmark. They for sure joined this claim, claiming that what Myanmar did to Rohingya has checks all the boxes of genocide, right? So this whole thing is, you know, it started in 2019, at the end of 2019, but it's still ongoing. What the International Court of Justice did so far is they introduced something that is called provisional measures. So this obliges Myanmar, the government, to stop any act of genocide or something that could lead to genocide in the region. They need to file regular reports on how they're stopping it, but it doesn't do anything. So in order for this to stop, there would have to be a resolution in the United Nations and in the Security Council, of course. And now here we would have for sure veto of China and Russia here. They declared that. So there's no way that anything could really happen, anything with power. If the International Court of Justice decides that this, in fact, is a genocide, then we will see. Then maybe, you know, Russia and China will be forced to vote differently. But at this moment, that's very problematic.
Wow. I read that there are some fires in the camp.
Yeah, there were actually, that's pretty common.
In the biggest camp, in the one Kutupalong. Kutupalong. Yeah.
There's constantly fires there, but there was just one right on, like, if it was not New Year's Eve, it was New Year's Day or something along those lines. And most recently, 4,000 shelters were destroyed. Wow. So think of just like a neighborhood loses 4,000 homes, right? And you had 50,000 people were left homeless, and that was just the most recent one. But there were other ones that went back. It's like at least one major fire every year. And we've done a lot of work on Lesbos with the fire of Moria and how devastating that was for the number of people that were there and how many were displaced. But this is on another level. I mean, like, because this area, every shelter is essentially made out of sticks. And
it's so dense there.
It's extremely
so
dense.
So next to each other, the extremely houses, dense. Yeah.
So when these fires have happened, I have some data here. Like 700 shelters were destroyed, 4,000 were homeless in 24.
This is one fire?
Just one fire. In 23, there was a massive fire that destroyed 2,000 shelters. And in 21, which was the first real big fire that we remember like making international news, it was like 15 people died and 50,000 people were homeless.
Wow, I mean, 50,000, that's a city. Yeah, that's a small city.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like really, really intense things happening. And then you couple that with the violence that's starting to happen on a more regular basis because of these groups that are kind of vying for control. You have a lot of people who are leaving here trying to get elsewhere, and they're trying to get on boats and go south, but then they're reaching resistance from all the other countries they try to go to. So most recently there were a lot of armed resistance from even university students in Aceh province in the top part of Sumatra in Indonesia to not allow boats to land. People who had already landed were kind of being attacked by teenagers, kicking them out because there was 1,500 of them in the taking shelter that they reached land. But Malaysia, Thailand haven't signed on to that convention either. They don't recognize the rights of them as refugees. Indonesia doesn't as either. So there really isn't a single country in the region where they can go to for like active refugee status and support. And some of the boats are being pushed back out into the open sea out of Indonesian waters. So they're basically just abandoned across the board. And now there's just like a real like crazy energy, pushing against them, no matter where they go.
All right. I think we're going to wrap this up, but we're going to continue for the Patreon. So if you want to listen more to this episode, you can sign to the Patreon and support us there. And thank you so much for my guests. We're going to continue, but just if you want to see more, Patreon, please help us because we really need your support to pay for stuff here and things and salaries.
You can how much support us depends on you. How the Patreon works is that you declare that every month you want to support our activities with certain amount of money, and it can be as little as like $3. So if you, instead of having one coffee a month, give us this money, then you have access to this fantastic extra content.
All right. Thank you so much.
I will have a coffee, but then also donate. Yeah. Also donate at least a coffee a day to Patreon.
You're donating to Coffee Island.
Our unofficial official sponsor of Coffee Island. And Aperture. Right? Thank you for the lights. You're awesome.
And thanks to our production team, Suda, Ellie, even though she's not here, but she still supports us. And we have two new members, Daria and Lota. Thank you so much.
And an old member, Davood.
See you next time, episode 17. Take care. Bye-bye.
I think we need to get some squeaky oil stuff. I feel like anytime I move in this chair, I'm killing the sound.
This WD-40. That's the best.
What are you, from America or something?
That was my dad's thing. It was his solution for everything. The like, same, you know, garage pros, WD-40.
Okay, but you knew it as WD-40 because I don't even know what to call
it.
I don't even know what to call it. I just call it WD-40 because it's like, you know, didn't call it film, we called it Kodak.
No, this
you
is called
We don't call it soda, we call it Coke. Yeah. You know, we're product
based. Product society. People.
You have to start.
I don't even know if there's another product like this.